I think we're seeing sort of fractured solutions, right? So we always say the first set of innovation comes in the silo, right? Everybody works in the silo and then it bubbles up. What we're not seeing quite yet is the connected solution.
Hey, it's Ray. I'm here at the Health Conference. Me and 12,000 other health leaders, we've all gathered together to discuss some of the biggest topics in healthcare. And there are a handful of areas that are so big and frankly so hairy that the health team has dedicated entire days for their discussion. And you know that on Radio Advisory, we are all about untangling the toughest challenges in healthcare. That's why I'm about to go on stage. I'm talking about GLP-1s. What they can do, what they can't do, and how providers, plans, manufacturers, PBMs, and vendors can work together to provide comprehensive obesity care. Honestly, it's a continuation of the conversation we had on Radio Advisory just a few weeks ago. All right, let's do this.
Health devoted an entire day, an entire summit to the conversation about GLP-1s. And this particular session is titled, GLP-1s, What Can't They Do? Now, I think that title is really interesting because if you are an optimist about weight loss drugs, you probably read that title as GLP-1s, What Can't They Do? This is Vegas, after all. If you are a pessimist, you may have read this title as GLP-1s, What Can't They Do? Now, I'll be honest, I don't want to be the pessimist or the optimist. I actually want to be the realist. I want to give you the real answers to how GLP-1s are affecting patients, members, people in their everyday lives, and what it means for healthcare business. And to do that, I've brought three fantastic guests to the health stage and to Radio Advisory. We have Rob McNaughton, who is the CEO of Calibrate. Calibrate is an organization that is devoted to providing intense lifestyle intervention with medication when necessary to provide better metabolic outcomes and sustainable results. We also have Rita Glaze-Rowe. She is the president of an expert team at Real Chemistry, an organization that exists to provide the right insights to executives to help them understand how new market dynamics, like the onset of weight loss drugs, will impact real executives. And then lastly, I have Dr. Spencer Nadolski. He is a lipid and obesity specialist who's also been at the forefront of telehealth and direct-to-consumer primary care. Welcome to Radio Advisory.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I'm going to admit the conversation about GLP-1s has a ton of excitement in the market. It also has some controversy, right? I hear some swirling conversations about, are we conflating weight with health? And part of that swirling conversation really has me wondering if our audience, if healthcare executives all actually have the same goal when it comes to weight management and when it comes to GLP-1s. So I want to ask each of you this. And Dr. Nadolski, I'm going to start with you. What is the goal that you hear from patients themselves when they come to you seeking something like a GLP-1?
Yeah, I always preface this and tell everybody on podcasts and during these conferences that I don't make money from big pharma, and I do that on purpose. But I'm a shill for these medicines. I love them so much because my patients finally feel like they have hope. They finally feel like they can actually do the things that they know they should do but can't do.
Hope for what? For weight loss?
Hope for weight loss and improving their quality of life. Like the patient that I had that said she could finally walk around Disney World with her family for the first time ever. And, you know, we had some of these older drugs that worked okay, and we had bariatric surgery, but that's only limited to a certain population. So she finally felt like she could do the things that she always wanted to do and perform the lifestyle changes that she always wanted to do but really struggled doing.
Rita, you work with health systems and providers.
Payers, let's be clear.
But for the purpose of this question, let's channel the provider mindset. What goal do they have in mind when they think about GLP-1s?
Well, I think they have several, and it's multifaceted. And I just want to build on what Spencer said is we do hear that. We hear that from providers and health systems all the time, which is, we all talked about for years and years and years how much the system was burdened by obesity, how much cost was burdened on the system by obesity. And here we have these incredible tools now in our toolkit to be able to offer and administer, which also comes with an associated burden. But we also are talking to them and they're finding the happiness. Like, we had a couple of providers that we interviewed basically say, I use a happiness scale now because my patients who come in and they're starting to reach their goals, they're literally smiling more. They're telling me the good news about the things that they can do that they potentially couldn't do. And I think when we look at it from an overall system perspective, we're looking at that from a population health. Are we making the communities healthier that will then make our systems a little bit flourish in a different way?
So the physicians themselves are happy about better patient experience, providing some actual hope to patients that maybe didn't feel like bariatric surgery was right for them or it was out of reach.
Right.
From a business perspective, those providers are thinking about outcomes.
Right.
Now, take me to the purchaser landscape. What are you hearing, Rob, from health plans and employers? What goal do they have in mind?
Well, speaking for employers, I think there's a broader realization and progress that obesity is not a matter of willpower, but it is actually a condition and disease. And so we're seeing that in the health community, public policy front, and consumer. From an employer standpoint, I think they look at these weight and obesity management solutions as being one of the few points of light in U.S. healthcare that actually has the promise of reducing total cost of care, which has been something that they've been looking for and hoping for literally decades of underwriting cost of care for their employees. So I think there's a general, you know, excitement and interest, and then it's offset by uncertainty and concern about what would be the costs of this. And so I think that is the stage of the life cycle we're at with employers as purchasers.
I want to run directly at that for a moment. And the word cost, I'm going to admit immediately, is going to get confusing really quickly. Because when we talk about total cost of care, we're talking about how we are saving money over the long term by improving outcomes. What I hear from employers, I'll say, is the cost right now, right? The price of the medication and the very large indicated population, which, by the way, is only going to get bigger, and they're saying, hold on, I need to avoid paying for this as much as possible, particularly because I'm not sure that the average employer or private health plan is going to see that long-term benefit of total cost control, because an employee is going to leave after 2 years or 5 years, or they're going to see churn in terms of their member population if you're speaking to a health plan. So my question is, how should purchasers think about covering these drugs? Or maybe the better question is, how do they get value from GLP-1s?
From an employer standpoint, I think it's really a matter of the drugs are just a powerful tool in a broader care plan. These are powerful, like GLP-1s, as Spencer highlighted, are powerful drug therapies. But I think the viewpoint that's coming to the fore is that they are literally and figuratively not the magic pill. That you can have better results and more sustainable results when the GLP-1 therapies are dovetailed with lifestyle intervention and coaching and behavior change, particularly around pillars of diet, nutrition, sleep, exercise, and behavioral health. And so I will tell you the journey for employers based on our experience at Calibrate is evolving. And there's employers, I'll say, at different areas of the life cycle. You know, we're seeing, for lack of a better word, a desire for employers to have a social contract with their employees in the sense that before you become perhaps eligible for a GLP-1 drug coverage, you actually have to commit to the lifestyle intervention and coaching platform first. So you're 3 to 6 months on the lifestyle intervention and coaching. You then weave in the drug therapies. And then over time, for a subset of the population, they may be actually able to titrate and consume less of the drug, yet still retain the tremendous health care outcomes that you've seen.
Yeah, they're trying to gatekeep the medicine to keep it cheaper. I think we should just blow up the whole entire insurance industry and everything like that anyway and make these drugs cheaper so that people are just paying cash and it's not tied to any insurance in the first place. That would be my, obviously.
All right, let's run at the manufacturers
then
for a second. No, truly, truly, because from the employer standpoint, or I should say the purchaser standpoint, they're doing exactly what you said, Rob, which is let's focus on utilization management. Let's make sure the right patients have the right access to these drugs, but not more, because we can't afford any more. Now, the manufacturers, they have the opposite goal. They want as much utilization as possible, so much so that we see manufacturers say, no, you're not going to get a rebate if you add step therapies. If you say you're going to add wraparound lifestyle support, which is exactly the purpose of this conversation. So then my question is, how do you think the manufacturers are going to change in the future, especially in a world where I'm willing to bet we're going to see a lot more competition for better, cheaper, easier to administer drugs.
Yeah, I like how Lilly stepped in and started this Lilly Direct, and now you can get, you know, the lower doses. Hopefully they open it up to more doses. And Novo, I hope they are listening. I don't know if there's any Novo people here, but I hope they start doing this direct. We start cutting out these PBMs and really start making it direct to patients and skip these middlemen. I think it's just ridiculous because otherwise they're going to be, we had a whole thing on compounding earlier. Compounding wouldn't need to be a thing if we just make these drugs cheaper and we use the actual legit FDA-approved versions.
Well, and also you're going to see competition, right? So we hope, right? The hope is if we see price compression with competition, you will have more than likely more than 18 come into this market across the next 5 to 10 years. And that's different dosage form, right? We're going to see injections. We're going to see orals.
That's right.
Going to see this market sort of manifest
and orals
in a
are,
number
of
different ways.
Expensive.
We are very early, right? And I know that the gatekeeping is real, but there is also on the self-insured side, there's also opportunity for them to design. And this goes to engagement, right? So we're also looking at it from an employee engagement perspective. Employees are now making choices about who to work for, whether they have the right program.
That is
in
exactly
place.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's a pressure that they're feeling from a different way too.
In fact, we have data that 44% of employees would switch their jobs
that is
in
exactly
order to
right.
get access to a GLP-1, which is a number that I think actually kind of terrifies employers because they're thinking, oh gosh, I really need to figure out a way to pay for these drugs. And of course, employers are saying, my healthcare costs are already wildly unsustainable. What am I to do?
Totally agree. We're seeing the uptake in terms of employers offering weight and obesity management as a covered benefit going up by orders of magnitude year over year. Our research suggests that about a third of all employers do offer it. They tend to be larger employers. So it's probably 40-45% of the population probably has it as a covered benefit. Now, yes,
weight management as a covered benefit.
Weight management with, there's, I'm sure, utilization management constraints and things like that. And again, these GLP-1 drugs are powerful therapies, but they also don't work for everyone.
Yes.
And so that's why we have to think about this, I think, a little bit more broadly and a little bit more around as part of a more comprehensive care program. Because, you know, depending on the research you read, there's 10 to 15% of the population who just don't respond to these medications, and potentially another 10 to 15% that have significant or moderate enough side effects that they may come off as well. So you have a material part of the population that this may not be the best therapy for them. And so as an employer, how do you manage that material subset of the population as well?
I want to actually run at this for a moment, right? We know that GLP-1s are really powerful drugs. I want to be really, really specific about what the data shows, the clinical trial data shows that these drugs can do. I want to talk about what we might expect them to do next based on the clinical trials that are in progress right now and where that falls short. What do we know in terms of weight loss? Let's start there.
Yeah, so when you think of like lifestyle, the average is around 5 to 7% total body weight loss, and that's with a pretty good program.
Pretty
that's over the course
program.
Of a year. It can be a lot less. Some people can have a lot more. You look at like phentermine topiramate, the Qsymia, that's around like 10 or so percent total body weight loss. Bariatric surgery, on the other hand, is like 30%. So when Wegovy came out, semaglutide in 2021, around that 15% weight loss, now we're starting to bridge that gap in between lifestyle and bariatric surgery. You look at tirzepatide or Zepbound, we're starting to see 20, even up to 25% total body weight loss if you extend that. Newer agents coming out, we're probably going to see in the 30% range. We're getting into bariatric surgery levels.
What about beyond weight loss? What do we know that these drugs can do when it comes to, say, cardiometabolic health?
We publish our research every year, and at Calibrate every January, we publish our results. And in the most recent January report, our results with large Ns, like 16,000 people, at the end of year one, our members lost on average 16% of their body weight. And this was in a world of just semaglutide, tirzepatide hadn't really hit the market. But at the end of year two, it was 18%. And these are real world results, typically characterized by a period of pretty severe supply chain issues. And on average, our members only had access to the medication for 7 of the 12 months. So at the end of year two, having 18% body weight loss is pretty impressive. And that allowed our docs and our clinicians to have an informed view of titration and tapering and how best to, you know, still utilize the lifestyle intervention and coaching in concert with the GLP-1 drugs to drive these, I'd say, over-index and better results out there. So it's, again, using things combined. And then our research also shows that waist circumference goes down, A1C goes down, like, frankly, yep. a whole range of metabolic metrics increase.
Yeah, I always have this joke on social media because, like, people are like, oh, what about the long-term side effects? I'm like, the long-term side effects include decreased risk of heart attack, strokes, kidney disease,
yep.
liver disease,
yep.
sleep apnea, you name it. So the SELECT trial was the big trial that came out last year in November, almost a year ago, that showed, hey, we already showed in those with type 2 diabetes, these drugs can reduce cardiovascular events.
Yes.
It was the first time they finally showed that those without type 2 diabetes but had cardiovascular disease at baseline reduced cardiovascular events. So these drugs are not only weight management or type 2 diabetes drugs. These are cardiovascular disease drugs.
And by the way, there are clinical trials in process right now for sleep apnea, for chronic kidney disease, for Alzheimer's, for osteoporosis. And so, like I said, we're going to see the therapeutic scope get bigger, which means that the very problems that we are discussing now, how do you pay for it? What do manufacturers do in terms of rebates? How do we get this in the hands of patients who need it? That those problems are only going to get bigger.
They're also going to expand the value discussion, right?
Yes.
So we're talking about, there's nothing more expensive than hospitalizations, right? Nothing more expensive that we think about every day. So we're going to see this as we see cardiovascular risk reduction go down, as we see these events go down, you're going to stop talking about sort of cost in general, and you're going to talk about value being generated. Like, that's where we have to get to. And it's not on drug alone, but it's about managing this thing we've called obesity for so many years. And we've studied it as a wedge. We studied as a wedge for all of these other things. And so we're going to start bending that cost discussion to go into a value generation.
Yeah. And to that point, these GLP-1 drugs have a pervasive impact, as obesity is probably the center pin for at least 40 other chronic conditions. And I think this is going to touch on something earlier you said. There's a component about value creation, in the sense that these therapies, particularly done in concert with lifestyle intervention and coaching, can, and I believe will, reduce the total cost of care. That's the value creation side of things. The next question that I think you were aiming at is, who captures that value,
yep.
particularly from
yep.
an employer standpoint? And I will tell you that there's probably been a gravitational pull in terms of our go-to-market, in terms of those employers that have longer employee retention periods, whether that be, you know, their unions or trusts or federal employees, because there's greater confidence and conviction that if the value creation comes to the fore, which I believe the folks that are jumping in now, those decision makers do believe there's that likelihood that they will be the ones that have the best chance to capture it. And that's why they're able
and
to
And we'll see continued pressure on the purchasers to cover these drugs as we get more information in terms of their clinical outcomes, right?
Absolutely.
Medicare in particular isn't going to be able to ignore this for much longer. Rob, you said these medications are not a silver bullet. How does the clinical trial data translate to the real world? Where do these drugs fall short?
Our vantage is that the clinical trial information is still evolving.
Sure.
The studies that come out that you had highlighted, they show that the GLP-1s do work. And then when people come off the GLP-1 drugs, they gain the weight back.
And there's a pretty sizable portion of the population that comes off the drug within the first year, I think 25%.
That's another element. But I think the rhetoric around the study I just highlighted is that then the takeaway is, therefore, these drugs must be chronic. I don't think that's the takeaway. I think that's a pretty myopic aperture. I think there's going to be more studies that look at the use of GLP-1s done in concert with other elements of lifestyle change, and they can show what the impact is of GLP-1s as a result. Like, for instance, our empirical evidence at Calibrate shows that people lose more weight when taking GLP-1 drugs when combined with lifestyle intervention. And for a subset of the population, they can indeed taper and titrate, in some cases, off of medications altogether. And I think you're going to see more studies around that. And then, you know, more importantly, there's also data out there that shows between 10 to 15% are non-responders. They don't work. And then another material percent have potential side effects that, unless you're working with a clinician, you're more likely to come off. And as a result, to your point, 2/3 of people who go on GLP-1 drugs today tend to come off.
What's the physician perspective here?
Yeah, I mean, we want people to also stay on these drugs if it has that cardiovascular benefit.
In the same way that they would stay on, say, a statin?
Say a statin or whatever else. And some people will want to taper off, and hopefully if they want to, you can help them do that. But if you're going to your local med spa and getting bathtub tirzepatide,
yeah,
and you're not giving them good guidance, they may have some side effects or whatever. We don't even know what they're putting in their tirzepatide or semaglutide. And then you're not monitoring them. They could come off because they have some reaction and then never show back up to that med spa. So you want to be working with a program, whether it's a Calibrate or any other program, that will actually monitor and titrate the medicine appropriately. And if the patient wants to titrate off, you help them come off or whatever they want to do. So I think the adherence part is very important. And there's some good data to show that, hey, maybe the local anesthesiologist who decided to open up their own med spa is probably not the best person to be getting this from.
Well, and also let's talk for a minute about where care is actually being delivered, right?
Yes.
So care is being, like, the majority of this is being done at the primary care office, right? We did an analysis across 49 different clinical trials that are going on, and the endpoints that are being used are actually not getting into what is happening in the real world practice, where care is actually being delivered in the primary care office. So there's a tremendous amount of education that needs to take place about how all of that clinical trial data actually gets sort of into real world practice so that we can begin to manage the care appropriately.
And this is exactly why we need to be talking about GLP-1s, and we need to be talking about comprehensive weight management support. Now, I think it is easy to simply say, yeah, we need to focus on physical activity and nutrition, but we all know that the answer is not as simple as eat less and move more. Frankly, if it was that easy, the four of us would not be on this stage at Health having this very conversation.
I'd be walking somewhere.
So my question is, what's missing from the conversation about comprehensive weight management that would help us actually get to sustainable change?
Yeah, so I'm a big shield for lifestyle as medicine, but I'm also a big shield for these medicines themselves. The big thing
out
there,
by the way, sounds counterintuitive. Why is that not counterintuitive? That you're a shill for these, you're a self-described shill for these medications, so, but you're also a physical activity junkie.
Yeah,
can I say that?
Yeah. So the thing is, some people respond really well to lifestyle by itself.
Yeah.
Some people do. There's always going to be diets and things around, and there's not everybody's going to want to take these medicines. I could see a future where we're all just taking these medicines, but at the time being, there's going to be a portion of the population that never wants to take these medicines, and they can respond very favorably to lifestyle. You see it everywhere. 10 to 15% of people that do these trials will have the results of something like a Wegovy or a tirzepatide. But the big concern with these are rapid weight loss, and people are worried about body composition changes. So not just looking at the scale, but looking at what happens to their body composition. And
meaning they're losing lean mass, they're losing bone mass.
Yeah, we're worried about muscle. So if people just get thinner without improving their outcomes, and we do see reductions in heart attacks regardless, but we don't know in the future, like, what if these people then come off these medicines, regain their weight? Do we know the body composition changes when they regain the weight? Are they regaining mostly adipose tissue or fat tissue and not regaining that muscle that they had lost? And then they keep cycling back on and off. Are we going to end up with more of the sarcopenic obesity, which is essentially, you know, the derogatory term is skinny fat. So I don't like using that term, but that's how people kind of interpret it.
Yep.
So imagine being just thinner, but not being able to do those activities of daily living, doing all those things like walking around Disney World and those things. So I think it's really important as a comprehensive program that we're at least encouraging and nudging people towards that. We can't force people to do it. It's all about behavior change and trying to figure out how to get people to do that. But the drugs will enable it at least. So if you're not talking about it, the patient's not as likely going to be nudged in that way of doing that. So at least some programs, I know Calibrate does it, the programs that I've been associated with do it, but putting it out there, Rito's talking about primary care offices. You have 5 minutes to talk to a patient. You write them the script. You say, get the hell out of my office. On to the next person. Do they have the time to actually deliver that comprehensive care? So ideally, you would have programs that you have dietitians, you have exercise physiologists, you have behavior change therapists, you have a psychologist to deal with the mental issues that people go through. And now that they've lost so much weight, I have patients that are having affairs because they're getting attention from other people now. So I'm like, I don't know how to deal with that necessarily. I'll talk to you.
But I appreciate the fact that as a physician, you're saying, hold on, my knowledge falls short of this. And there is a piece, there is a gap that is missing to actually not just support my patient in their weight loss journey, in their chronic disease journey, but in all the ripple effects that that's going to have on their life. And Rob, I know that one thing that I think Calibrate believes is missing from the conversation about weight management is behavioral health. Can you talk more about that?
Well, absolutely. And we have our four pillars of lifestyle intervention. So it's diet, nutrition, sleep, exercise, and behavioral health. And that is a new use case that I hadn't heard pop up in ours. But it's everyone's journey is unique. And that's why we are a firm believer of having it be a physician-led lifestyle intervention and coaching platform. Every journey is unique. And we do believe, and I think our empirical results would show that for a material amount of the population, the lifestyle intervention is completely additive or multiplicative force factor on the drugs themselves. And, you know, to Spencer's earlier point, some people respond better to lifestyle intervention and behavior change than others. And, you know, as a result, their journey could be different than someone who doesn't. And, you know, in terms of the behavioral health, yes, there will be aspects that, you know, our coaches will chat about and our doctors will chat about with our members. And it's just part of a more collaborative and comprehensive care plan associated to one's unique journey.
We'll be right back with more Radio Advisory after this short break.
Follow the 2024 elections with Advisory Board's daily briefing newsletter. More than 165,000 healthcare leaders read the daily briefing because it's the best 5-minute snapshot of what's going on in healthcare right now. Go deeper than the headlines with healthcare-specific insights on the presidential race and the latest news on the key state-level races and ballot initiatives that will shape the industry's future. Subscribe to the daily briefing by clicking the link in this episode's show notes.
You're listening to Radio Advisory. I'm Ray Woods.
There's a great question that just came through in the chat. We're talking about comprehensive weight management programs. Who is actually doing that? Who is actually creating, providing, offering comprehensive weight management? Rita, you're smirking. Is anyone doing this well today?
I think we're seeing sort of fractured solutions, right? So we always say the first set of innovation comes in the silo, right? Everybody works in the silo and then it bubbles up. What we're not seeing quite yet is the connected solutions, yes. Right? So, and they're all valuable, by the way, but we're not seeing sort of fully connected solutions. And I think one of the things that we talk about all the time and sort of getting removed from this is we talk about people as this journey just started, right? For most of the people that we speak to about this, their journey's been lifelong, right? They started to getting judged in seventh grade and now they're in their 40s. So for them to sort of look at themselves in the mirror and say, diet lifestyle, has it worked for me for 35 years? Why would it work now? And so why would you put me through another 6 months of that? Is really where the reality of most of this journey is. And so when we look at how do you do that comprehensively, it is also a sort of social and societal game too that we have to start playing. And one of the people who came very strongly and said, it costs us nothing to change how we talk about obesity.
Yeah. And I'll tell you from the health system perspective, every single business leader that I speak to on the provider side is thinking about how do we create a comprehensive weight management program. Frankly, a lot of them are thinking about this as a way to create different channels to other parts of their business. And I do even mean changing the pathways for their own surgical volumes. And I don't just mean bariatric surgery.
Because they've invested in those lines of service, right? They've invested in bariatric care and they've invested in those lines of service. So now they look at it from that community perspective to sort of say, how do I have this? And there's a lot of consensus building that needs to take place too. Clinical consensus building around then what those pathways should be. So we have yet to see that.
And I think this is a microcosm of a bigger issue. At Calibrate, we wish and try to collaborate with PCPs as much as possible. To your point, PCPs are overwhelmed. And as our health system becomes far more specialized, like you now have more specialists focusing on certain conditions and certain elements, it's becoming more fractured. And it's making the comprehensive collaborative care effort more difficult. And frankly, as a healthcare sector, that's where, you know, I think the hope and intent of technology, interoperability, and speaking as a provider organization, we don't feel the tools are there yet.
And on that note, I want to channel, there's a cynic in the audience who I love. I love a good cynic as one, as a self-described cynic myself. I want to ask, why should we actually believe this is possible, right? We know that obesity and chronic disease has grown virtually unchecked over the last several decades. Why should we believe now that comprehensive weight management is actually possible, given all of the challenges within the current delivery system?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about comprehensive delivery system, but these drugs are going to be doing a lot of the heavy lifting. We just have to kind of support them.
So what's changed is the drugs.
The
themselves.
Drugs, it's just ridiculous what's coming down the pipeline. These newer drugs are just going to melt the fat off of people. And I'm worried that some of the wrong people are going to take them and end up basically skeletons walking around. This is how good these things work. So these drugs are, they're going to be so abundant. 5 to 10 years, we'll look back at these conversations of compounding and all this stuff, and we'll just laugh and how this, like the wild, wild west. These companies, manufacturers are going to come out with newer and newer, better versions of these things. And
the CDC just released information last week. Obesity in the U.S. went down for the first time possibly ever. Again, we're not hanging the mission accomplished banner up yet by any stretch of the imagination. But it was, I think, the last study was it was at 42.9%, and now it's at just over 40%. So it has ticked down, and it's certainly been timed with, I think, the rise of GLP-1. So we are having an impact. I think the numbers show we're having an impact. Now, much more work to be done, much more evolution and development needed, such that we can touch on your next question of how does this, where do we go from here?
I mean, but it does beg the question of, in a world where, and I'm going to be blunt here, the traditional healthcare system has failed to deliver comprehensive obesity support to date. We know then, because there are gaps in our system, that there are new market entrants that are coming in. There are new drugs. There are new vendors. Rob, I'm looking at you over here. There are new partners that are coming to the table saying, I can help not just with the administration of GLP-1s, but with this comprehensive weight management support. Now, the rub is that some of these things maybe should be held sacred to the traditional delivery system. Some should be outsourced. What needs to stay within the traditionals, and what should we outsource to the non-traditionals?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see healthcare change over the course of this next decade. I think we're seeing innovative ways of delivering healthcare that are just, do people even need a PCP? I'm a PCP, so like, but is it going to start changing to where you just get your care a lot online and you have some in-person doctor for acute care? I think a lot of these innovative ways of delivering healthcare are going to disrupt the system, because academic healthcare systems are where you usually see these comprehensive obesity treatment programs, but they're not scalable. You can't, they're only in metropolitan areas.
Sure.
So what about the person in a rural area? They go to a telemedicine place where they can finally get access to these because their primary care doctor doesn't have enough time for them or can't even get them in.
And let's be clear, they're solving actual gaps for those patients, for those users. So then perhaps the question is, how do we prevent fragmentation? I know that the traditional delivery system is not exactly known for being frictionless. So then if we have different partners who are providing different aspects of care, maybe even purposefully, right? Spencer, you said, I don't have time or know necessarily how to do the same thing that a dietitian or an exercise physiologist can do. As we have more players that are filling reasonable gaps in the system, how do we prevent fragmentation?
Can we answer the cynic for a second?
Yes, please.
Okay, go, do it.
We haven't talked about incentives. We haven't talked about aligning the incentives to get to that comprehensive, right? Because the more we have the what we will deem to be traditional, along with different doors, right? Different doors to enter that system, we also have to make sure that the incentives are aligned to deliver that care in a way that gets us to the health goals, right? And we don't.
In the right timing, too.
In the right timing.
I think it's a microcosm of a bigger issue. As healthcare, we have become more specialized, which is good because you have a higher degree of expertise and understanding of a given condition. And if done appropriately, you can treat more people. And so, because there is scales about specialization and focus. And to your point, it comes down to economies. If someone is underwriting the cost of healthcare, they're going to look for that. And so there may be this internal dissonance or friction as, specialization increases and, the need for collaborative care increases, but the glue in the system isn't there yet. I am hopeful, optimistic, largely for incentive reasons, that there will be a solve for this.
Yes.
I just don't know if an incumbent or a player in one of those specialist areas can make the investment necessary to be the collaborative glue across all sectors.
Mm-hmm. To that note then, do we think that these kind of partnerships between the traditionals, the non-traditionals. And by the way, when I say non-traditionals, I don't just mean vendor partners. I mean folks that we typically just think of as being outside of healthcare, right? Nutrition actually being one of them, right? Physical activity, exercise physiologists being one of them. Is this a temporary stepping stone, these new partnerships, or do we think we're describing a more permanent way of moving forward and thinking about the very way that we address obesity as a healthcare system?
Yeah, I mean, you go to other countries, it's more like the socialized healthcare. Everybody has the same EMR and they all talk to each other. You put some note in it, everybody in that country can see it. Ideally, all of our EMRs would all talk to each other. You put a note in whatever EMR you're using, it would be able to transfer to whoever else is using a different EMR. I think that's the concept. I know a lot of people are trying to do that with these health information exchanges. But if we could move forward with that, that would be great, because I don't want to use Epic necessarily, or someone else doesn't want to use XYZ. How to get there, though, I don't know.
Can we talk about the generational force as well, right? Sure. So we've got younger generations who are coming in who are already living a little bit healthier, right? And they're also demanding more from our healthcare systems, right?
Yes.
Demanding more, and we're seeing that more and more. So as we sort of see this come together, we're going to see these natural inflection points where they just won't stand for.
So maybe you think permanent. Maybe you think the traditional healthcare system has failed this new generation. And so we're going to see more folks like Calibrate that are saying, here are the four pillars that we need to provide to real people in order to create sustainable results.
Because it becomes about relationships, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for those relationships. And PCPs who have 5 minutes aren't going to be able to sort of deliver on that sort of relationship around their
or deliver on their goal, right? As we started off with,
and their goals can be individualized, right? Yeah. So are we going to get to that personalization?
Spencer said something that registered with me, and it was to the effect that healthcare is going to change over the next decade, and I think it's going to change profoundly. I'm not necessarily certain how. I do feel good about Calibrate's positioning in this space, but the point is, and I think it actually lends to your notion of incentives, is that there are incumbent players today that have revenue and profit pools, and then based on their dynamics, that will essentially determine their appetite for partnership, collaboration, and progress. And I can't tell you how that's going to play out, because I think a large number of incumbent players will have very different philosophies and strategy. It will be exciting. I'm not sure I know where that direction goes, but to your point, I'm pretty confident it's going to change a lot in the next decade.
Let's go there last. Before we wrap up our session, I have two rapid fire questions that I want to ask each of you. We started off this conversation talking about goals and almost kind of naming how patients, healthcare systems, and purchasers might have slightly different goals. Let's do this rapid fire. How will we know when we're actually successful as an industry? And maybe you can even predict when that might happen.
I think when everybody who needs access gets access.
To GLP-1s.
Or whatever comes down the pipeline, yes.
Rita?
We start to achieve actual population health goals, where we start to see that we maybe can fly a small W.
A line that where we see pervasive improved healthcare outcomes, and ideally the total cost of care in this country goes down. To me, that's the win, because then it becomes sustainable. And then you get to have the true population health metric improvement across not only body weight loss, but the myriad of other metacardiobolic metrics that enhance people's lifestyle or quality of life and just dramatically reduce other chronic conditions materially.
If that's where we ultimately need to get, what is coming next when it comes to comprehensive weight management that you want everyone in our audience and everyone listening at home to know so that they can take action at their organization?
These drugs will enable the behavior change, but they won't do the behavior change. You just need to nudge them into that once they have that drug with them.
We need to continue to have this conversation and make it be meaningful for the people we're trying to treat.
Yep.
Absolutely. And these GLP-1 drug therapies, as well as the literally hundreds that are probably in the pipeline right now, we believe that they're best utilized in concert with lifestyle intervention and coaching. Yep. They don't solve for it, but they certainly enable it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me at the Health Stage and on Radio Advisory.
My biggest takeaway from that conversation is that I'm not sure that when it comes to weight management, we're all operating towards the same goal. Does everyone need to be on GLP-1s? What are the essential elements of comprehensive weight management? And who really needs to be providing that support? Look, we may be at a moment where there are still more questions than answers, but that doesn't mean that we can afford to wait. There's just too much demand, too much excitement, and too much at stake. We have to come together to address comprehensive weight management. And remember, as always, we're here to help. Next week on Radio Advisory.
Employers are really looking for something different. Plans are looking for something different. And that's where ICHRAs enter the stage.
New episodes drop every Tuesday. If you like Radio Advisory, please share it with your networks. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating and a review. Radio Advisory is a production of Advisory Board. This episode was produced by me, Ray Woods, as well as Abby Burns, Chloe Baxt, and Atticus Roche. The episode was edited by Katie Anderson, with technical support provided by Dan Tyag, Chris Phelps, and Joe Schrum. Additional support was provided by Leanne Elston and Aaron Collins. We'll see you next week.
Hi, it's Abby Burns, co-host of Radio Advisory. This episode is coming to you on Election Day. As you probably noticed, we didn't do any election coverage or speculation today, but later this month, we'll have two post-election episodes that'll unpack the outcomes and their implications for healthcare. On November 19th, we'll be breaking down what the presidential, congressional, and state elections results mean for healthcare leaders. And then, on November 26th, we'll do a deeper dive into the healthcare policies that you might need to pay attention to in the upcoming year. In the meantime, you can visit advisory.com to get all of Advisory Board's elections coverage. You can also register for Advisory Board's post-elections webinar on December 17th. The links are in the show notes.